I grew up with all of these stories, how important it is to stand up for what is true and right, even though you're in the minority of one. My logic mind said, get the hell out and stay away from it. But there was something in my heart that just said, go, go, go. Sometimes I feel that there's something bigger than us that are sort of showing us, trying to guide us into areas where we're supposed to go. It's the victimhood that is a major trap. It's a major trap. If you see yourself as a victim, I think you're on the wrong road. I don't know any person who's really made a difference in the world, who's had an easy life.
My friend Heather has put together a video showing how she has overcome virtually every insurmountable obstacle in her life. Now she's devoted to inspiring others to do the same and to start living your dream, whether it's traveling, attracting wealth, a great relationship, or just becoming happy. She has developed a really absurd but extremely effective manifestation formula, which essentially fills in what is missing from The Secret. It directs the universe to give you the life you've always wanted, happiness, success, freedom, and more. Watch the video with the link below. Get ready to be inspired and never let any obstacles prevent you from loving and enjoying your incredible life. No more excuses. Follow the link below. Business Game Changers, I'm Sarah Westall. Today I have Ole Damegaard coming on. He is considered the top expert, or one of the top experts in the world, on assassinations and propaganda and mass shootings. He has created a template for, well, just 3 years of research looking at every single assassination that has gone on, major assassination in the United States and elsewhere around the world. And he's figured a template of what's behind it and what's really going on for mass shootings. He's figured that out as well, whether it's a government false flag or whether it's, you know, a possibility of it being real. He's created this formula that he can tell what's really going on and whether you should automatically suspect there being questions on the reality of it being a false flag or not. Very interesting character. And we have, ends up being a two-part show just because he's so fascinating to listen to. There's so much to learn. And we just kept diving into things. And then he decides to stick around for my Patreons. But what he does is it gives a direct message to the elite. So what I'm going to do for my Patreons, I'm going to put it up there for about a week. And I'm sure the elite are going to see it in that time frame, having it up on there on my Patreon. And then I'm going to release it publicly so that hopefully it can go viral. I would like to see many people seeing it, but it's his direct message to the elite. He's been doing this for, you know, many decades. He's the most peaceful man. He won the Prague Peace Prize in Czech Republic, and he's won a lot of artist awards, but he's known for just trying to educate people and create peace. So his message to the elite is a warning of how many people are waking up and that you should be scared and that you should be figuring out how to do what's right. And I welcome everybody to go to my Patreon page and see it. It's going to be up there for about a week privately, and then it'll go public. So let's now get into my interview with Ole Damegaard. Hi, Ole. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Sarah. We meet at last.
Yes, this is great. You are wonderful. You've won a lot of awards in art, which is incredible, but you've also won the Prague Peace Prize in the Czech Republic, which I think is really something spectacular. And you've spent a lot of your life doing research in areas that help humanity. Can you talk about what your areas of research are?
Well, I'm sort of like I used to be a total one-man band that was just trying to, you know, find out what the hell is going on, because I've, on a very early stage in my life, I found myself very confused and not understanding, because I felt like there's something that doesn't match up. I'm being lied to here on a major scale, and I don't understand why, because I was brought up, in a family where it was very important to be honest and stand by your word. And also, I come from a background where my family was in Denmark, was involved in the Danish resistance movement against the Nazi occupation. And so I grew up with all of these stories, how important it is to stand up for what is true and right, even though you're in the minority of one. And how, like my granddad was in jail for helping Jews to Sweden. My dad was in the resistance movement, the armed guerrilla forces. My grandmother's mother used to supply weapons to these groups with them in a baby cot. And so on. So I think I grew up with it. And also, but I also grew up in a family where, with a very dominant militant dad, who we had like, it was called a democracy, but it was a dictatorship more or less. It was beautiful on the surface, but it, just like Henry Ford said, you know, you can color, you can paint the Fords any color you want as long as they're black. The same type here. So I grew up in a family like that with a very dominant dad, and in where the surface looked really beautiful, but underneath the surface, something totally else was going on. So we were sort of the perfect family. At the same time, we were under this very dominant rule. And so I believe that I got very sensitive to people lying, to people manipulating, to when the whole truth was not being told. And where it's like I sometimes I feel I always have, I almost have like antennas on the outside. When somebody starts lying to me, it just goes, something is wrong, something is wrong. And so this has been very helpful for me, because I used to see myself as a little bit of a victim from my childhood. But now I just see it as boot camp preparing me for what was supposed to come. And so over the years, I've really done my very best to become a good person, to live my truth and live in peace, to treat the world around me respectfully. And I mean, this has taken very strange ways. Among one thing was that I, for some bizarre reason, decided to take a bicycle, an old bicycle on my own, 1984, and just head out into the world. And I thought I was going to South Africa, but somehow I misread the map and I ended up in Iran in the middle of the war. It was in 1984, just when after the revolution, when the situation was absolutely horrendous, when Khomeini was as brutal as he was during these years. I mean, there were mass executions, roadblocks everywhere. Iraq was bombing Tehran every night, at least every week, and I had no idea why I got myself in there, because my logic mind said, get the hell out and stay away from it. But there was something in my heart that just said, go, go, go. And at that point, you couldn't get in there because Iran just wanted all foreigners out. I mean, most embassies were evacuated. There were hardly any foreigners there at all. And the people in Iran, so many of them tried to escape. And so there were all of these thousands of people trying to get out. And here I was trying to get in. And why? Sometimes I feel that there's something bigger than us that are sort of showing us, trying to guide us into areas where we're supposed to go. And I have been not understanding that when I was on the bicycle for these months on my own, because it's a very lonely thing when you're alone on a bicycle, you know, because if you see anyone else on a bicycle, they would be a mile away and you will never catch up, or you will meet one and they would say hello and they're gone, because you just met them. And in those days, there was no mountain bikes, there was no one else that I knew that did these things. And I really am not sure why I did it, but I know now why I did it. I didn't understand when I was doing it. And I think very often life is like that. It's like reading a book. It's first when you read a chapter and you start seeing, aha, it's because, and you go back, you browse back in the earlier chapters, you see, it's because that, had that not happened, I would have not have been able to understand this situation. I wouldn't have an empathy for this individual. I wouldn't have an understanding for what's going on here. if this had not happened. And now these things are happening that I don't understand, but I'm sure in a few chapters down the road, I will start to, aha, that's why this. And the more I started seeing life like that, the more magical it becomes. And
the less you're hard on yourself or you feel like a victim. I love the boot camp thing. Your childhood was like a boot camp because I feel that way a lot. And experiences that you have that you thought were just incredible, like why did I have to experience that, really helps you later in other things. I love that idea.
It's the victimhood that is a major trap. Mm-hmm. It's a major trap. If you see yourself as a victim, I think you're on the wrong road. You will see, I think that I don't know any person who's really made a difference in the world, who's had an easy life. I mean, most of them have been beaten up, they've been raped, they've been plundered, they've been put in jail, whatever. But through that, they managed to stay in balance, or they managed to gain balance and an inner strength. Because life is like a gymnasium, you know, like, okay, what do you want to do?
Exactly.
If you want to...
Are you having trouble losing weight? It could be due to insulin levels that are out of balance. Learn what fat-flushing food helps balance your insulin levels. It's basically a hormone that determines how much fat your body stores. Over 240,000 women have successfully melted unwanted fat off their body fast, faster than you would think possible, keeping it off for good. Learn how so many people have melted fat so quickly. Click the link below.
If you want to pump some muscles, okay, go to a normal gym. If you want to get some spiritual muscles, get yourself some trauma. Get yourself some war. I was heading into war zones all the time, real war zones. And I was being drawn there, and I did not understand why until I started seeing that I was just trying to prove my worth to my dad, I believe, and to show that I am me. I am myself. I'm worthy to be alive. I am a man, even though maybe he couldn't see it, or maybe I thought he couldn't see it, because we were very different. But it was that, or I really needed a shrink, you know. So anyway, but I managed to, instead of staying in an asylum, I managed to direct this from going from victimhood into making a difference by, in this case, I had some Iranian friends that were in a very, very dangerous situation. One of them got murdered, and I said, I'm going to do everything I can. So I risked everything, and I managed to smuggle one of them out from Tehran, from Iran, that was absolutely closed at the time, through former Russia, East Germany, up to Sweden, where they tried to deport him, but we managed to stop that as well. And then later he got permission to stay, and now he's a heart specialist in Sweden. And later on, we got seven more out to Sweden and to Canada. So I think I feel very, very proud of that. That instead of me sitting whimpering in a corner saying I'm a victim, that because that was a major trap. I felt like a victim for many years. That I managed to tunnel or sort of funnel this into something that made a difference for other people. And in this case, through an old bicycle worth $50. So I thought, I like that. I'm very, very happy for what I did. I've written a book called Shadow of Tears. It's the true story about this whole thing. And my intention is to get this made as a major movie, because it's a beautiful story. It's got all the ingredients. And while we were going through this absolute hell, several times we were like, oh my God, somebody should make a film of this, because you just can't make it up. But at the same time, it's without explosions and hide, you know, car chases and all the drama, but a soft-spoken, very, very intense drama, and very, very beautiful. And I hope with the book Shadow Tears that I managed to, my intention is to sort of like build a bridge between the hearts of different people from where we find. What I found was that I thought I was going into a country filled with crazy people screaming Allah Akbar, shooting each other. But what I encountered was in the streets, very terrified people and the women, you know, covered in black and very, very strange to me at that time. And then I was invited to their homes. They opened the door, put on Michael Jackson, off with the charter, and like, oh my God, totally different world. Like that I knew of, but they were in this horrific situation, not for any of their, it's not because they did anything wrong, it was because there was oil in Iran that everybody wanted, and the strategic position of that country, making a target for all the major nations and forces in the world to just rape and plunder, and because of this, they were suddenly in this situation. I happened to be in another country without oil, and without a strategic position. I mean, so the difference was my parents had sex in a different piece of land, in a different piece of Mother Earth, and that made me free at that time and them in absolute hell. It's bizarre, and it can change so easily and well, so fast as well.
Well, it's crazy to even think about being in an environment where there's mass killings. Can you imagine your neighbors being rounded up and mass killing and how you would feel? I mean, I just want to get out of there.
And so what did thousands and thousands and thousands of people, and they fled. But many,
can you do? I mean, or, you know, I could see people, you flee or you fight, but if you don't feel like you have the, I mean, sometimes the smartest thing to do is just get out of there. Because if you can't, I mean, what am I going to do? Fight back against an army?
But Sarah, the thing was that this was done by deception as well, if we look at what happened in Iran. But what was done was that the Shah was put there, if you want to go into this area, in 1954, there was the CIA went in there. There was Mossadegh, a very, very loved politician in Iran, that was really working for democracy. He wanted to kick out British Petroleum and England out of there. So the CIA said, no, that is not okay. They went in, they got rid of Mossadegh, and in they brought who became the guy that became the Shah.
Yeah. And that's dad, well documented and known.
Yeah, yeah. And in the book also, I go through the whole development, the whole political background, how this happened. But then the Shah in the face or in the eyes of the Western world was this beautiful emperor. You know, he was sitting on this... throne and all the magazines that the hairdresser had beautiful pictures from his parties and so on, and he was worshipped all over the world, and very few people knew what was actually going on under the surface, because at the same time he was trying to force his country into control and modernizing it very, very fast. This was not a super religious country, it was just an ordinary country where there was a religion called Islam. And they're not Arabs, it's not nothing like that, but there are many different levels of faith and groups of people and so on in this country. So many people reacted, and so the CIA sent in and trained what was called SAVAK, the secret police of Iran, and they were trained to be extremely brutal, and so they forced people into obedience by torture, executions, all of these. But this was under, sort of underground. You couldn't see it on the surface. But it came to, it escalated to a point where people had just had enough. It was just enough. And so this whole thing ended with people making an uprising. You know, people just went out in the streets and said, enough, enough. We can't take anymore. So the Shah, the military tried to break them down, kill them, stuff. But one of the things they didn't, they weren't really thinking of was that in the customs in Iran, it's like if somebody gets killed, then the family meets, I think, on the 15th day of that individual's death, and then again on the 40th day to celebrate the memory of this person, and then again a year later, and so on. So if you have several hundred people killed in one of these demonstrations. And you suddenly have all the families gathering on day 15 and day 40 and a year after. And then new people are being killed when they gather because they try to stop all of these groups and gatherings in the streets. And also people were getting very, very, they were so frustrated and they've had it of all of this over the years. And so it just escalated. And so when you look at it, what happened was that this people, more or less unarmed, managed to throw out the fourth strongest army in the world.
And they did it together by bonding. You said they were unarmed?
They were.
It was just the collection of persistence of wanting to get this, but so many of their loved ones died. So would you say that they got to, because I think if my children died, I wouldn't care about my life anymore. I mean, I would just be fighting and maybe I would fight peacefully, but I wouldn't be scared at all about my life. And do you think they kind of got to that mental state?
Totally. And I'm going to come back, Sarah, later in this talk. I want us to come back to mothers that will not back down, because that is the reason why crisis actors were created, in my humble opinion. So I want to come back to that later on. But this whole thing escalated. And in the whole revolution, the Iranian revolution, what people was focused on was to get rid of the Shah. They didn't really check out Khomeini. Khomeini was a priest, a mullah, that had been kicked out by the Shah. He had lived in exile in Iraq for many years. And he, at the point of the revolution, he was in Paris. And so the only place where people could meet in secret were in the mosques. So there were lots of secret meetings in the mosque and so on. So the mosques became like a network of resistance against the Shah during these years. So when Khomeini, through the mosques, he became sort of like an icon and a symbol for the whole fight against the Shah. So nobody really checked out who is Ayatollah Khomeini, Ruhollah Khomeini. They didn't check him out. He just became the symbol of freedom and wonder and liberty and all of these things. And people were like, oh my God, I can see his face in the moon. He's the liberator. And so they gathered around him. They managed to kick out the Shah. I mean, the Shah did everything he could. He sent up helicopters, tanks. They blocked in people in cinemas, turned it on fire, burned people alive, everything they could. And in the end, just couldn't stop it. So he said, well, sorry, I'm out of here. He took his helicopter and boom, he left to the States that used to be a friend. But now suddenly, no, very sorry, you're not welcome here anymore. So the U.S. closed the door for him as well. So he had to go to Egypt instead, where he later died from cancer. So much for loyalty. But once he got kicked out, Khomeini came in and he was welcomed like the savior, like Jesus Christ on earth. So he came there, and for about 6 months, the people of Iran were celebrating. They were so happy, freedom at last. So all the resistance groups, you know, the Mujahideen, all of these different political parties and that had been underground before, they stepped up. You know, they stepped forward, they were giving speeches in the streets, they were dancing in the street, they were all of these things, you know, not knowing that Khomeini, one of the first things he did when he came to power was to grab the Salak, the secret police of the Shah, and say, okay, guys, now you have an option. Either you work for me or it's chop, chop, head, go, go. And so many of them said, okay, not a problem. I will survive and I will work for you. So people thought that they had got rid of the Salak, of the secret police, that all the jails now could be turned into water basins or whatever. And instead, for these 6 months, the Salak just kept on monitoring all future resistance. So they mapped the whole future resistance network. And then after 6 months, you said I would fight or I would fly, escape. But overnight, one night, nobody expected anything. There was mass arrests in the thousands at nighttime. They just arrested people, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, where they took you, your children, your father, your mother, your siblings, your cousins, everybody, because they knew if they take you, chop your head off, whatever, in the future, your children would become a problem. So they tried to sort of knock the whole thing out in one go. So people woke up, just like with the Berlin Wall. It was not there one day, and boom, suddenly the wall was there. And once they started building the wall, it was too late to get out. Exactly the same thing in Iran. And so many people found themselves from going from the ash into the fire. You know, they were so focused on getting rid of the Shah, and suddenly they found themselves in a situation that was even worse. Because now also they were being pushed back into like 500, 600 years back in development, in freedoms, liberties, the equal rights of women. I mean, all of that went back to the Middle Ages in a go like that overnight. And it was like, if you're not with us, you're against us. You choose.
And then what happened in the country? Because now United States and Iran are like this, right? That's theater as well.
Oh God, there's so much deception going on in different levels, and I shouldn't really say anything about this because I haven't been involved with the situation in Iran for many years, so I don't really know what's going on now. But what I do know, on the world stage, so much is a theater. It's the New World Order agenda that are playing chess with us, where they don't see nations as country. It's just the different pieces on a chessboard moving around with the intention of global domination.
So now where do you see, because maybe you can't answer this, but I'm going to ask you anyways. Trump just did a tweet last week that was really aggressive against Iran. What is the deal with that? I know it's all theater, but do you have any idea what's really going on with that? Justification to sell weapons? Justification to move, to keep the wars going? Is it more than that?
It is. I've never voted. I have yet to meet a politician that I can trust. They say government, is a Latin word for control. The mind control, that is the meaning of the world government. When you see how the game is being played on a with the world, one of the things is that it's through the banks that they control countries. It depends on different countries, different agenda. You know, like some countries they knock out financially with the World Bank and the IMF. They give them all these loans and say, you should grow cotton. Cotton is the greatest thing. The whole country should grow cotton. We will give you all of these loans. And the country, whatever, Ghana or Zimbabwe, whatever, they will say, okay, thank you so much. And then when the whole country is suddenly, the whole old infrastructure is gone, everybody is growing cotton, they say, well, we're very sorry, we're going to buy cotton from Colombia. So suddenly they leave the country in total devastation. There you go into starvation, all of these things, people panic, and they say, please, please save us. Well, the only way we can save you is, and in comes the IMF and the World Bank and offer all of these loans again, that where they will never, ever get out of it. And the money goes to government things like highways or harbors or airports that doesn't gain normal people anything. So that's one way. And you got like financial hitmen that goes in there and do it in different ways. Then you got like military aggression, where we're just gonna totally destroy you, but we will call it Operation Stardust or something beautiful. We will go in and fight for democracy. Absolutely not true. It's rape and plunder, total destruction. It's brutal death. That is the thing. And I'm sorry to say, the U.S. is the terror tool of the world. I'm quoting now whistleblower Chip Tatum. He says, and he's been in the U.S. military his whole life, he's fighting and doing everything he can for the veterans' rights and so on. He says that the U.S. military is the terror tool of the world.
It's interesting that the U.S. military members, they are the ones that are the most for pulling out of countries and downsizing, you know, getting their soldiers out of other countries.
Who is?
The military veterans. I mean, like, they tend to be more libertarian and be smarter about how we go into all these other countries. I know that, like, Ron Paul, this was last presidency, he was more supported by veterans, even though it was the mass media wasn't covering at all, than any other candidate. And he was for, you know, having a strong defense, but really changing how we go about doing our offensive actions everywhere.
I can only ask, what the hell are you doing in the rest of the world? All of these army bases, all of these countries where there's American military bases, had these been Chinese military bases, people would go, oh my God, or Russian, oh my God.
Or any other country.
Any other country.
Except ours. We feel safe because it's us. But God, think of how everybody else feels.
What the hell are you doing here? This is, I'm not talking to you, Sarah, but you represent a country by your nationality. And I'm just like, when I go to different countries, like if I go to Germany, for instance, Germany has not been liberated since World War II. They're still under occupation by law. They're still under occupation. And who is there? It's the U.S. that are occupying Germany. It's bizarre.
Well, and how much of are we and our military pawns for the global elite that aren't necessarily Americans anyways?
The way I understand the global elite, they have a special structure. They've got three different centers. They've got the financial center in the old city of London. They've got the religious center, whatever that means, in the Vatican. And then they got the war center in Washington. And then you got, like, everything is being transported between the three. It's like everything from drugs to pedophile trafficking to human slaves to organ trading to you name it. It's wars. It's one big just circling.
It seems like they've given up on legitimate business in a lot of ways and have just decided it's easier to make money on drugs, human trafficking, war, and financial scams.
Sarah, we're looking at super, super, super criminals, but in a very nice package. They look nice. They say nice things. They are super criminals. Super. I cannot exaggerate. I mean, like, for instance, you take Bush Senior. I mean, if you don't know what a monster looks like, I'll show you. If I don't have anything against him as a person, but look at his actions. Oh my God.
I have a lot against him as a person. Actions are the only thing they are as a person.
That is true.
That's what that I'm down true. To actions. You know, it's all about actions. It's not rhetoric. Because I can go up there and look, or anybody can go up there and sound like you're just great and all loving, and then go and do something that's absolutely horrific. And the problem is people can't get past that. All they look at is what people say. You got to look at actions. Actions are who you are. So when you say, you know, I have a lot of problems with that person.
And I say thank you so much for correcting me, because I meant he sounds nice. He looks nice.
Sure.
He does. But my God, when you see the actions, when you see the level of criminality, him, his father, his grandfather, I mean, Boy George as well, the whole Bush dynasty, it's mind-blowing. And that's just one part of this whole machine. So
they're kind of a minor part in a scary kind of way. I mean, they were instrumental in helping them get the kind of the whole process is going, but as they're dying, aren't they kind of like moving out? I mean, they were just kind of like soldiers for them. He was the hired CEO for a while of a certain network, and they just hired someone else. That's kind of how I see it.
You got like his granddad. He was the guy responsible for the Zimmerman telegram. That was a fake telegram that got the USA into the First World War. Then you have Prescott Bush, the father of George, who was the guy that funneled the funds into the Hitler war machine with the help of the Dulles brothers and so on. So that's the Second World War where they were there. Then you got young George Bush Sr. that as a, at a young age came into the CIA. He was the paymaster for a special hit team, an ultra-secret hit team called Operation 40. That was a major part of the assassination of JFK. George Bush Sr. was even in the Daltex building when the shooting occurred. Nixon was also there. The whole bunch were there. That's also why they call it the big event, because so many people were there. They knew what was going down and so on. And then Bush, through his whole career, he surrounded himself by key people in this ultra-secret hit team called Operation 40 or Group 40, like Felix Rodriguez, many of these. You have David Morales and so on. They were part of taking out Robert Kennedy as well and Martin Luther King. And so he surrounded himself by these. They were also very central in the Vietnam War, where Felix Rodriguez and many of the people that were involved in the JFK assassination were also very central in Operation Phoenix in Vietnam. But they were also sent down into South America, where they organized so many of these military coups. They took out Salvador Allende. They were part of executing him and taking over. They were educating the police forces in all of these different countries, including El Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras, into making them to absolute slaughterers and murderers and torturers. Same people, same key people that were doing these things. They were also sent into Southeast Asia, which was one of the main reasons for the Vietnam War, was the drug trade, to get that going. So they even used dead bodies of American soldiers. They just gutted them, filled them with drugs, and sent them home in your brothers and sisters. And so this is how they were using that. And in the same time, making millions and millions and millions and millions from producing weaponry and wars. And it's disgusting. It is.
You know, those kinds of things, you know, people knew that the soldiers' guts were taken out and drugs were put in just so they could. Those are the kinds of things that would cause revolution if people. But the thing is, they won't believe it. They won't believe you. You know, a lot of my listeners here will. Or the new ones might be, wait a minute here, and might turn it off and say these people are nut jobs. But in general, people will, because they're the types that have heard and seen this. But a lot of people can't, they just can't believe it. It's just too hard for them to, you know, that's evil.
But we're talking evil.
Obviously, yes.
Is it not evil to go into a totally innocent country like Iraq
yes, it is.
And totally destroy the population? I mean, 50% of the population now is under around 15. They're only kids. Everybody else has been killed, and all of it
in
based
where?
On fake,
in where?
Fake Iraq and based on fake terror.
Just sad. And all these children are being raised without parents, and so it's just sad. I have a really soft heart for children. I mean, really hard intensity. So don't say that I'm soft in that way, but soft from they need our care. And so when you have a whole country of children without parents because we did that to them or whoever did it, I'm not going to say we because I would never partake.
No,
in that.
I know that. I know that.
But, you know.
But it is is your country, and it is also my country, I'm very sorry to say, because I was born in Denmark. Denmark is part of NATO, and NATO have been part of these operations as well.
It's all of us. It's all of us. You can't just say the U.S. It's the whole NATO alliance and all.
Yeah.
You can't – it's not possible to blame it on one country because the other countries can stop. There's more to it. But let me ask you – you know, we talked about the Bush family, and I said it, I see it more as a CEO, and as that family dies, they replace it. Now, do you see him more as an orchestrating character, and that whole family is an orchestrating character that really ushered in this new age of whatever we're in? Or do you see it more like there were players above them, and they were kind of their leadership arm for a while?
Total players above them. I mean, they are way down, but still very, very central. But it's like a godfather of a mob family. their different mob families. There, he was sort of the godfather of his clan, but above them, I mean, major players, major ones. So they're puppets as well, but extremely destructive and evil puppets. So, and it was interesting because I've always wondered how it is to meet people like that. And I've been in contact with several people that met George Bush Senior in person, worked with him and so on, like Chip Tatum, the CIA whistleblower. He was actually the commander of George Bush Senior's private hit team called Pegasus, where he was part of taking out at least 14 people in the Western world. And he said that George Bush is the most brilliant person he's ever met, but he's also by far the most evil.
And because there's a lot of brilliant people, but is he saying because he's so able to devoid his, you know, to separate his emotions from his thinking, that he's able to mentally go farther than an average person is, which makes him almost more brilliant? There's a lot of things I can't think about because I won't mentally go there.
And that is what blocks us. That is why you are not in a position like that. Because they need very brutal rulers that have no feeling for the victims. It's for them, it's just collateral damage, you know, the more the better. Many times it's like that, you know, the more soldiers killed in that area, great, that then we can get more funds from there, or we can do use that. And so,
people like us, and I would assume, I can make decisions where there's going to be collateral damage for the general good. I could do that. It would be hard to it wouldn't be hard to make the decision. It would be hard to live through it, you know, because I know the pain that is being caused. But if the overall general good is way better, I would be able to make that decision. The problem is that these people are making decisions where they don't even care if the collateral damage is larger. It's the goal is not about the general good. The goal is about whatever agenda they have.
It's their greed. It's only about them. It's only about them. They have no. That is also why to put people like that in a political situation where they are there to take care of us and to protect us, that's the worst mistake you can make, because they're totally on. You can't trust them. Their loyalty is to their own greed and people beyond them, behind
this.
Total psychopaths.
Yeah, the weird part. And this is where the cognitive dissonance jumps in, is that they're so good at seeming like that's what politicians are. They're so good at seeming like they have so much empathy, but they don't. You know, they in their speeches and how they react to people, like patting you on the back, whatever.
You asked me about Donald Trump before, which I didn't answer. I don't follow politics at all, but when I see Trump, because if I'm correct, the last real president that ever was JFK, and he was slaughtered. And he even came to power through the help of the Chicago mob, through his dad. So that wasn't really a real election either. It was somewhat rigged. But he was the one, I believe, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, where the world was so close to get into a nuclear war, and where he was the one that was sitting with the finger on the button that could have started it, where the whole army around him and his advisors just shouting, press it, bomb them, bomb them, bomb them. And people who were there said that he was sitting there with tears in his eyes just saying, I refuse to be the one that does this to the world. And after that, I think that there was this transformation from like a more or less a rich man's playboy, a rich man's son, playboy, a glitter and glamour, Marilyn Monroe type, you know, like person who entered very young into the White House, to a very determined individual who said, my God, the level of madness is, we're going to destroy the world. We need to make a stand here. And that's what he did. He said, I'm going to destroy the CIA into 1,000 pieces. I'm going to withdraw out of Vietnam. The war hadn't even started on the American part. There were only so-called advisors there. It was a French war that the U.S. had just taken over. It had not started yet. I'm going to withdraw everybody. I'm going to get the Federal Reserve Bank back, you know, I get the silver value back into the to the dollar. All of these type of things, he got rid of Alan Dulles and these other holy cows in the CIA. It was unheard of. And there were more reasons as well. Do you know his brother, Bobby Kennedy, he put him in charge and started a witch hunt on the mafia. Sam Giancana, Trafficante, these type of people, Meyer Lansky, that had helped him come to power. And then he turned the back on them and said, well, we're going to burn you. Thank you so much for getting me in here, but I'm going to give you the finger and some jail sentence to serve. So within 1 year, the victims, again, mob members, went up 700% under Robert Kennedy. This bull terrier of a man, he was not very big, but my God, he was like, you don't want to mess with this guy. So he just went wild to get them because J. Edgar Hoover had totally denied the existence of the mob up to that, because they had him by the balls. They had that he was homosexual and a cross-dresser or whatever. So he was under their control indirectly. So he didn't even look at them. Then once it was really obvious that it's actually because existed, he said, no, the mafia, no, it's Cosa Nostra. That's a totally different thing. No, it's the same. It's the exact same thing. So these things came to a point where all of these forces just said, we are going to take this mother out, this JFK, and statue an example. That's why they killed him in broad daylight, in front of cameras, in front of people, because the message they sent out was that we can get anyone at any time, anywhere, so whoever you are in the world, back off, because if you stand up against us, we will destroy you. That is the message that was sent out. And you will see very often when it comes to top political assassinations, there are like two conspiracies. One, the conspiracy of the assassination itself. And then there's a second conspiracy following of silence. Is this silence? Is the official story or nothing? And what is that based on? It's because people in power positions, so-called power positions around in governments and wherever, they don't know the details, but they know the power behind this termination of a high level individual. And that is why they shake in their pants and they bend over and bow, and they will support whatever the official story is, they will go that way.
Because they're afraid. See that. Well, let me ask you, because you're an expert on assassination. I mean, that's where you really started, from what I understand, is really diving deep into that. Is there a pattern that you've seen with assassinations?
Yay, baby. Yeah, you can say that again. My God, the pattern is so, so clear. And I started out around 1980. I became so interested in the JFK assassination. It was way before the JFK movie. It was way before anyone was looking into it. At least where I came from, nobody was interested. You could hardly get books in
Jim
Danish
Garrison.
Or Swedish.
Jim Garrison was, but they shut him down as much as they possibly could. But anyways, keep going.
No, I'm so not the first one who just started looking into it. I'm saying where I came from.
No,
Scandinavia.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
These people, I mean, from day one, people like Mark Lane and other incredible researchers that started right away saying, my God, what just happened in our country? You know, what went on here? Really tried to do, and many people published books and so on, but there was no real reaction to the whole thing. But
well, and that was what was crazy. I don't mean to cut you off, because I just had an interview with John Barber. I've been getting emails from some crazy, yeah, I love him. I've gotten crazy emails from people that, well, one particular documentary maker who claims that everything the government says is true. And maybe someday I'll publish these emails back and forth. I was ready to just tell him to go. I have a bridge to sell him if he believes all that crap. But what I've learned is that there were people, but they, you know, the censorship was almost total and complete before the internet came up, because there were people trying to do things, but the Mockingbird media, the Mockingbird CIA project, really shut these people down. That was such a successful operation. to silence anybody doing any research on JFK.
I would change the wording to is the most efficient. It's still in place.
Yeah.
My God, it's even bigger now than ever.